The next case is 06-1808, Joseph Talick versus Federal Marine Terminals, Inc. Justice O'Connor has recused herself on this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice O'Connor, Judge Joseph Vukovic, who's the judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 7th Appellate District. Welcome, Judge Vukovic.
Thank you.
Ms. Keith-Walker.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time.
Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is Irene Keyes-Walker, and in this case, I represent Federal Marine Terminals, Incorporated. As a stevedore, Federal Marine's obligations to provide compensation for its injured workers is governed by the Longshore and Workers Compensation Act, Longshore and Harbor Workers Compensation Act, excuse me. And there is no question, it is undisputed, that they did so comply with those obligations in this case. The question for this Court, then, is whether, in light of that compliance, the exclusive liability provisions of the Longshore Act preempt an employee's attempt to seek tort damages for a workplace injury under Ohio common law, and specifically Ohio's common law substantial certainty workplace tort, also known as a Fife claim. That claim is preempted both expressly and impliedly under Ohio law. For express preemption, of course, we must look at the provisions of the Longshore Act itself, and there are three salient provisions. The first, for a twilight zone worker, as in this case, a worker who actually is on land performing maritime activities, the employer, Federal Marine, must get two types of workers' compensation insurance. It must contribute to Ohio's Workers' Compensation Bureau for state benefits, and it must either self-insure or obtain a private insurance policy to provide federal workers' compensation benefits. Second, the employee, who is a twilight zone worker, has his choice of going after either state compensation benefits provided by Federal Marine, federal compensation benefits provided by Federal Marine, or both, in which case he gets to keep the highest paying and get the most benefits possible. Third, once those two obligations have been complied with, the Act provides that such liability is exclusive to all liability, either in law or in admiralty. And it is that exclusive liability provision that is express preemption in this case. The only express exception in the statute to that is if the employer does not comply with its obligations to obtain the necessary benefits, then the employee may sue. Otherwise, all suits are preempted. Now, there are some states and federal jurisdictions that have held other certain exceptions may potentially exist, but none of those are suitable for the facts that we have before the Court today, and therefore this Court need not decide any of them. The first that you've read about is some court saying, well, we believe that an employee could bring a suit under the Longshore Act for an intentional tort if there is a specific deliberate intent to injure a particular employee, specific and deliberate intent. Inapplicable in this case because Mr. Talick did not sue under the Longshore Act and because there's been no allegation at any time of a specific deliberate intent. Second, there have been some states that say, well, since employees can get state benefits under the state workers' compensation law or statute, then they should be able to get the whole benefit of that statute. And if that statute provides, for example, a penalty for a rule violation or some benefit that's part of the statute, we think that's okay. Again, this Court need not decide that issue because in this case, there's no claim being made under Ohio's workers' compensation statute. The claim is a common law claim. And then third, the most extreme any court has gone is the Louisiana Court of Appeals in the Transocean case. It's not been cited by any other court, but their reasoning is, well, if an employee can bring a deliberate intent claim under the Longshore Act and Louisiana allows you to bring a deliberate in tort claim under Louisiana law, we don't see any harm in letting that occur. There is no conflict to be preempted. Again, this court need not decide whether it would follow the minority position of the Louisiana courts, since we don't have any allegation of a deliberate intent tort. Again, we have a substantial certainty intent common law claim in Ohio, and that's the only thing in issue.
In that, that seems to be the conduct or the situation, circumstance that is not covered by the federal act. Do you agree? In the definition of injury, injury does include a deliberate or willful act of another person, a third party, not the employer. So the act doesn't speak to the intentional tort, the Ohio type of intentional tort, does it? Or am I missing something?
That is the reasoning that has been used by those courts that hold that because there is no express description of intentional tort liability or immunity, therefore we can look to this description of injury, which includes accidental, and we could conclude that there could be a federal common law intentional tort claim, but it would be deliberate and specific intent. I believe that reasoning is not particularly applicable to preemption cases because it really is a coverage question. If you define injury as arising out of accident, then are your benefits only available to injuries arising out of accident? It really does not apply to the question of once you have received compensation and it has been determined that this does meet the definition of injury, does the exclusive liability section apply to bar all suits at law or in admiralty? And my argument would be that the correct application of that interpretation would be that it does the express liability exclusion would apply here because it's undisputed that benefits have been received.
What is your most persuasive U.S. Supreme Court case, if there is one on that narrow issue?
There is not an on-point U.S. Supreme Court case. The closest that I would suggest for this court would be the Lockheed Aircraft versus the United States. And that is, I believe, a 1990 decision in which the court is actually construing an analogous statute that was based on the Longshore Act. And it simply states that as part of its discussion that the Longshore Act established a quid pro quo by which an employee gives up any right to sue his employer after receiving benefits. Now, the reason I mention that is because one of Mr. Talek's cases that he cites, Garmin versus Garlock, which is a Washington State case, cites to that U.S. Supreme Court case for the proposition that employees may not bring intentional tort suits under the Longshore Act. I also believe that there are several other U.S. Supreme Court cases, such as the Perini case and others, that describe this unique quid pro quo of the Longshore Act, where you get dual obligations to buy two insurance policies and you get dual chances to get the highest benefit possible as a quid pro quo for returning employers to the type of immunity from suit that they had before judicial erosion of that immunity in several U.S. Supreme Court cases. And specifically, what they were talking about is where the U.S. Supreme Court in the Ryan Stevedore cases said, well, an injured employee can sue a ship owner under strict liability, and that ship owner may then seek indemnity from the employer. So the employer was just put right back in the circle of exposure to additional liability. Those cases, I believe, when considered in conjunction, all come to the inevitable conclusion that it was the intent of Congress in the 1972 amendments to enforce the quid pro quo, which would prevent, at a minimum, state tort, intentional tort claims that do not require a specific deliberate intent. Whether it would bar more, this court need not decide.
In Arrington, we said that because the intentional torts do not arise from employment, there's no immunity for them. And some courts have said, therefore, since it doesn't arise out of the employment relationship, this exception requirement that you're talking about in 905 exposes the employer to liability for the intentional tort. How do you respond to that?
And again, I would say two things. One, it's counterintuitive to me, and always has been, quite frankly, that you can say that we're describing an injury as accidental and therefore intentional torts are outside of it, and yet that very same description of the injury gives rise to a right to benefits under the statute. How you can be both under the statute and outside of the statute, and I realize that this court has made that distinction.
Well, we've done it in Arrington. How do you deal with Arrington? This court has said that.
Well, that is an interpretation of the Ohio workers' compensation statute, not the longshore statute, and there are significant differences, especially when you look at the quid pro quo established and the requirements of preemption, which is not to say that a court, like the majority did in the 8th District, can impose a state interpretation of its own law on a federal law, but says that you have to look at the federal law and its provisions and congressional intent, not the legislative intent, when deciding what Congress decided. And in this case, you have significant differences between Ohio's workers' compensation statute and the federal statute.
There are several federal courts, though, that have not foreclosed the filing of these intentional cases.
All of those cases, Your Honor, have done so only under the requirement that any intentional tort would require a specific, deliberate intent. Basically the pick up the baseball bat exception that is the majority of courts in the United States apply to as the only, and including Larson's and all of the treatises, indicate that this specific deliberate intent is the only potential intentional tort exception to the immunity of state as well as federal workers' compensation statutes.
So, Ms. Keyes-Walker, when we talk about our substantial certainty tort, that really is, as you say, kind of outside the mainstream, is the Louisiana case similar to Ohio's situation? That's the case, I think, one of the cases the Court of Appeals looked to. Would you comment on that a little bit more, please?
The Louisiana case, which is Taylor versus Transocean, that the Court of Appeals looked to, said precisely because Louisiana state law requires a deliberate, specific intent as an essential element to any intentional tort under Louisiana law, we find that it does not conflict with the federal common law deliberate, specific intent exception. So they made the assumption that the federal law does recognize such an exception and then said Louisiana law doesn't conflict with that. We do not have that situation here.
So if we were to affirm, we would be the first court that would be taking this additional step, talking about substantial certainty satisfying the deliberate intent. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor, because that is expressly what the majority in this court, in this case, said, was that not only does the federal scheme recognize an intentional exception, but that it essentially would recognize a substantial certainty tort. It just tries to lift Ohio's reasoning and put it slam dunk on to the federal statute, and that it cannot do.
Counsel, the trial court granted summary. It didn't state why, and the Court of Appeals points out that Federal Marine had, in addition to arguing preemption, it said there was a failure of proof on the merits, and they should win summary on that basis. The Court of Appeals addressed both and said no preemption and that there was enough alleged to get by summary. Are you waiving off that second issue? You don't have that as a proposition of law.
I did, Your Honor. You didn't accept it.
Yeah. Okay.
So I would have loved to argue with you.
I didn't remember that, all right. So that's not before us.
Thank you, Your Honor. With that, I would like to reserve the bulk of my time, the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. Mr. Cook.
Good morning, Chief Justice, fellow justices. My name is Jerry Cook. Very honored to be here, second time in my 21 years of practice before you in representing the appellee, Joseph Talek. If I may address directly first the question by Chief Justice Moyer, it's clear from the appellant's brief filed by Federal Marine Terminal that there was never a direct treatment by them of the very definition of injury that is contained in 9022 of the Act. That Act and that provision defines injury as accidental injury or death, and it separately defines a separate injury contemplated by the Act, which is intentional injury by a third person against an employee as a result of their employment. That distinction between accidental injury and this willful injury by a third person was addressed specifically in a case cited by Federal Marine Terminal, which was Sharp versus Elkins. It was a Louisiana case, just like Taylor versus Transocean, but this came out of the Federal District Court. And what that court found was that the use of willful in the statute, not only in that particular section, but in 933I, where it is used in the immunity for fellow employee negligence, that particular use of willful connoted that accidental injury with respect to the employer did not even include willful acts of the employer, that the immunity granted by the Longshoremen Act would not even rise to protect the employer for willful injury. And that is a far cry from the substantial certainty of the restatement of torts, which was the applicable standard at the time that Mr. Talik was injured. Another point is, if looking at their briefs, you can tell that the principal authority for this proposition that the standard in Fife is not enough to remove this intentional tort claim from the coverage of the Longshoremen Act are the cases of Austin versus Johns Manville Sales and Houston versus Bechtel. It is abundantly apparent that those are the two principal cases for the authority for this proposition. Those cases, Hughes versus Bechtel, cites Austin, so it is duplicative in that sense because it relies on Austin, but both of those cases are recited numerous times by the other 10 cases cited both by FMT and by Joseph Talik, where courts have recognized an intentional tort exception under the Longshoremen Act. And it is interesting to note that in the Austin versus Johns Manville case, the court cites the restatement to describe what level of intentional tort would satisfy an exception to the Longshoremen Act. And it draws the distinction specifically by saying, however, a strong probability is a different thing from the substantial certainty without which he cannot be said to intend the harm in which his act results. So when you look at the principal authority that FMT is citing and you study it, you will see that the substantial certainty test was enough. And this case in Hughes versus Bechtel have been cited without real critical analysis and submitted for your contemplation by FMT as some established federal common law. It is not. What it is a citation to Larson Workers' Compensation. There is a compilation of a variety of cases in federal district courts that have borrowed
Do you have any case that directly holds that a state's substantial certainty test satisfies the Longshoremen Act of Deliberate Intent?
There is a case cited in the Larson treatise out of Louisiana that applied a substantial certainty state standard.
But I thought Louisiana standard was deliberate intent, not substantial certainty.
That's not clear. The Taylor versus Transocean case dealt with an assault. Taylor versus Transocean cited Austin and Hughes-Bechtel, but was not asked to opine as to whether or not lesser standards would actually remove the intentional tort outside of the immunity conferred by the Longshoremen Act. Taylor versus Transocean actually was a fellow employee assault, and that issue was not addressed. But I can tell you in this Sharp versus Elkins case, the court was very clear that because of the use of willful in the language of the statute, willful acts of the employer resulting in injury themselves would be outside of the act.
Let me ask you, I don't want to make your argument for you, but sometimes it helps. Isn't your strongest argument that in countering Ms. Keyes-Walker's argument that there's this exclusivity provision, that provision only applies to the injuries that are defined in the act? And the injury suffered by your client was not defined in the act. It was an intentional tort, as we define it in Ohio, and that's not even contemplated in the act, is it?
Precisely, Your Honor. If that was my objective in pointing out the definition of injury, the nature of the injuries that confer the immunity or that fall within the embrace of the exclusivity of the Longshoremen Act are accidental injuries by employers and limited forms of willful injuries inflicted against employees by third persons, not employers. So you're correct. Injury itself and the definition that is contained in that federal statute is the best expression of congressional purpose and intent with respect to what and what is not covered by this act. Since 1927, there has not been an amendment that defined accidental to include intentional torts of the employer. That could have been done. There has been no U.S. Supreme Court case expressing that point. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court cases that we cite, particularly Sonship, make it clear that for an employee who works on the land and who received the benefit of the Longshoremen Act for the first time in 1972, state law is still very relevant and cannot be displaced absent a clear and manifest expression of congressional purpose.
Well, I guess that's the issue for us, is when Congress adopts legislation on a particular area of human conduct, how far does the exclusivity go? How far does it reach? If the federal statute doesn't cover a subtopic of the general area of law, does the exclusivity cover that also, or is that left to the states to add to, if you will, add to the federal law, so long as it's not in conflict? I don't see our intentional tort law as being in conflict with the federal statute here. It just seems to be in addition to what Congress has adopted.
You raise a good point, and there is a statutory illustration of this. In 905A, if the federal employer, the longshoreman employer, fails to get the longshoreman coverage, that employer loses the immunity conferred,
right. And
an employee can sue him directly in negligence. And the employer, specifically in the statute, loses the common law negligence defenses, assumption of the risk, contributory negligence, negligence of a fellow employee. And so With respect to the negligence claim that is specifically provided for in that statute, there are cases where federal common law is used to uniformly develop the concept of negligence. But that is for a claim specifically provided for by that statute. Whereas in this case, this employer intentional tort is outside the statute and is a matter that has been traditionally relegated to state law, then the U.S. Supreme Court has shown an express predisposition to applying the state law that applies in a particular case. That would be, in this particular case, the Fife standard of substantial certainty, and it would be completely consistent with the Act.
But the Act in 2134 says, employers are assured that regardless of fault, their liability to an injured workman is limited under the Act. And the Act makes the statutory liability of the employer the exclusive liability for injury to an employee arising out of employment. In this case, the plaintiff recovered under the Workers' Comp Act, correct?
Yes, he did.
And substantial certainty, I don't care how you dress it up in legal terms, looks at the fault of the employer, does it not? Because it's not a deliberate act. It's doing something that you're so negligent or so reckless that something's bound to happen. So it's a different standard, and it looks at fault of the employer, does it not?
Yes, it does.
So then how do you rationalize that exclusivity language that says regardless of fault with the legal underpinnings of a substantial certainty claim?
Because the quid pro quo under workers' compensation has been and is the same for Longshoremen Act as well as the Ohio Workers' Compensation Act, that in exchange for certainty of recovery, efficient and economical recovery, an employee gives up his right to bring a tort claim for negligent injury. And the employer, on the other hand, gives up his common law defenses to that. It was never contemplated that in that quid pro quo, the implied employment agreement between the employer and the employee was that the employer could intentionally injure the employee and still.
But substantial uncertainty is not the same as intentionally injuring.
Under the restatement, the demonstration of substantial certainty, and even in the Austin case that FMT cites, demonstrates as a matter of law the intent to injure.
So we should have to read then into the federal statute if the fraud is so, or the if the fault is so bad it rises to the level of substantial certainty, we can get around this language.
I don't think you have to read anything into the Act because the Act clearly defines the injury, and it doesn't define the injury in that manner. So this is outside the Act. Just like we have determined that the intentional tort is outside the course and scope of employment for our own because we did not have a definition of injury, so we really had to look at course and scope of employment to determine whether that type of injury is outside the immunity of our statute. This statute has a definition of injury, and I think it's controlling.
Counsel, we don't see the Longshoremen Act here that often, but we do see a lot of preemption questions with respect to FELA.
Yes.
Are those statutes enough different that litigation in that area on this question would not be helpful in determining the preemption issue?
Yes, this is a very important question. The FELA cases, there are numerous Supreme Court decisions requiring federal uniform development of standards for negligence in those types of cases. We have nothing in the Longshoremen Act that comes from the Supreme Court or Congress expressing that type of interest in uniformity. There was no administrative board established under the Longshoremen Act to ensure uniform development of regulations or standards here. It is not the same as the National Labor Relations Act. or other acts where Garmin-type preemption exists, where the field is so occupied that there is no place for federal regulation. That is not the case here at all. If there are no other questions, I would grant the rest of my time to Ms. Keyes-Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Ms. Keyes-Walker, you have 1 minute remaining. Even with Mr. Cook's grant of time to you, you still only have 1 minute.
I'm going to try to make four brief points. One, Justice Moyer, Chief Justice, you asked about conflict. We did not talk about the biggest conflict of all, and that's a double recovery you get under the Ohio Fife tort. Under the statute, the longshore statute, you obviously get credit for whichever of the federal or the lower the federal or state benefits, so to ensure that the employee only gets one compensation benefit. Under Ohio's Fife tort, you get your benefits again, your lost wages and your medicals, as well as any other tort, full tort damages. So that is a direct conflict.
Well, second, Mr. Cook's brief makes the argument that Section 905 of the Federal Act says the liability of an employer prescribed in Section 904, which is the definition section of this title, shall be exclusive in place of all their, obviously, all their recovery. But what's your response to his argument that 904 is a definition, and the definition leaves out intentional tort by the employer, doesn't even mention it, refer to it?
Because, Your Honor, again, the exclusive immunity provision actually in full says exclusive liability shall be exclusive at law or in admiralty as to these injuries. So it, too, uses injuries that are called, defined as accidental. Therefore, our argument is, by the fact that these injuries have been compensated under the Act, they are not accidental by definition. If you're going to say that the definition of injury determines a conduct-based remedy, which we don't believe it does because this is a no-fault statute, that is not the use of the word accident in the definition is being too broadly used. But if you are going to take that position that, yes, accident means only negligent, then you also have to take the counter proposition that if compensation is paid for that accident, it cannot be intentional.
Maybe I could follow up on the Chief's question because I'm troubled by the same provision. You're talking about accidental injury, and injury is defined in 902, but it says, and it includes an injury caused by the willful act of a third person. I think the Chief's point is the same thing that's troubling me. It doesn't say the willful act of an employer or a third person. It just talks about the willful act of a third person. And your argument would be so much stronger if it had employer in there.
Well, and that's because that provision is broadening coverages. Everybody assumes that the accident or the injury is being covered based on some employer conduct, but there are lots of workers' compensation statutes that do not provide coverage if it's co-employee conduct that's intentional. So by merely assuming that the employer conduct, whatever it is going to end up in a covered employee. And can I make one more point here?
Sure.
That the very Sharp versus Elkins case that he cited, here's what it actually says. Accordingly, if an employer commits a willful act against its employee after making the argument you just made, then the injury to the employee apparently has not been caused by a third person, is not accidental, and thus not compensable under the Act. All of these cases, including Taylor versus Transocean, are founded upon the assumption that because the employer's act was intentional and outside the scope, it's not compensable. In this case, it was compensated, and that's a critical, critical distinction on the theoretical jurisprudential basis.
Yeah, your argument is, it seems to me, is that if the employee has been compensated under the Federal Act, that means there's been an injury as defined by the Federal Act, and so there cannot be, unlike in Ohio where you can recover workers' compensation and also recover intentional tort, which does seem a little inconsistent, but that's our law. So you're saying that for these purposes, that shouldn't be the law, that if you complied with the act and you received compensation because there's been an injury as defined there, then there cannot have been an intentional act as we define it.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the quid pro quo. You get speedy, fixed liability payments without fault. And the Spearman versus Exxon case, which is a Seventh Circuit case, it's on page 11 of our reply, criticizes some of these other cases that use the analysis like Taylor versus Transocean by saying, you know, even if a state workers' compensation statute codified something like a five tort, it's fault-based. We don't care what you call it, it's fault-based and has no place in the Longshore Act, which is non-fault-based.
And you've finally, used your time.
Make a brief conclusion.
I'm sorry, you've used your
okay.
Minute
I
is up.
His too, huh? Thank you. We would ask that you reverse
Thank
and
you,
reinstate.
Thank you, Ms. Keith Walker.